And these movies were shortened,
and altered
a bit anyway. So I mean, the shortest Godzilla movies. I don't know if this was on TV, but was it All Monsters Attack? The
Monster Zero.
Yeah, I think so. I think the classic media DVD is not even 70 minutes long, and it's just a bunch of stock footage and this plot where about this kid and Godzilla's son.
Oh, yeah. That one is called Godzilla's Revenge here.
Right.
that was a television favorite, that one. And it was just stock footage with some new scenes that were... it's a very strange movie. It's more about the plight of a little kid left on his own with his working parents and making his own way for himself than it is a Godzilla movie, per se. The Godzilla scenes were all sort of his dream sequences.
Right.
A very different take on the Godzilla. They were kind of starved for ideas at that point, I think. Or maybe they saw that kids started to really, really love the movie, and I think they just sincerely were trying to embrace that. Mm. But it gets a lot of flack, but I don't really have an issue with that movie. I think it's cute in its own private little way. Because it's sincere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, any movie below 70 minutes or below 80 minutes is instantly my friend.
Yes,
so,
exactly.
So I look forward to that.
Paced well. And the kid, it's a kid's movie. It's for kids. And even though watching it as a kid, you were a little disappointed that it wasn't a real, monster mashup. Sometimes just, talking at kids instead of just doing what you do, you get a better response just making the monster movie straight than saying, oh, kids like it, let's make one that appeals to kids. Mm-hmm. Kids might rebel against that, I guess, but I have no problem with it. It's its own thing, and it's cute in its own right. It has a crazy soundtrack. Mm-hmm. It's got crazy monsters in it. And it also features Godzilla's son over here, dubbed in English with a ridiculous voice that, was out of a vaudeville routine. So,
oh, sweet.
Yeah, amazing. like, ooh-hoo-hoo, like, really funny. So it is what it is.
Although I do have to throw just a sidebar there in that, As disappointing as the Japanese Kong was, it was nowhere near as bad as the Mighty Gorga.
Oh, there you go.
So, or any of those other films that David Hewitt put together. It's like, oh, Lord. Yeah, those films were a chore to get through.
Despite them being in the genre that they were, they were still a chore to get through and didn't even deliver on the monster action, if you will.
If you haven't seen The Mighty Gorga, it is the best way to put it. It's sort of like drinking way too much Patron tequila while getting a root canal. It's both numbing and painful at the same moment.
I'm a glutton for punishment. So.
Well, there you go. There's a high point in The Mighty Gorga where David Hewitt could only afford half an ape suit. And... So you never see Gorga from the waist down.
Oh.
And it's, of course, you always see the real actor's teeth behind the ape mask and all this. But the high point of the film is where the Mighty Gorga has the battle with the dinosaur. And the dinosaur is one of the cheapest plastic toys you have ever seen.
Wow.
I mean, it is literally one of those 99-cent dinosaur toys, and it's got a little spring-loaded jaw. It's got those the saw blade razor teeth sculpted in. It is just awful. And he's trying to do this forced perspective thing with the actors on the stage and a rear projection screen behind them that is not big enough to capture the footage. And the shots are just horrendously bad. But again, I would like to say it's so bad that it's good, but that would be giving the film way too much credit.
Gotcha. That's an important thing to note when talking about movies that bad. In terms of Mothra, again, a little side note, is the original ending still in existence?
You know, it's very possible it is. It's really hard to find out what Toho has exactly in their vaults. They're not really very forthcoming. And I don't want to say that they're extremely difficult, but they know that they have hot commodities. Their two hot commodities they consider are their monster movies, especially Godzilla.
Right.
And Kurosawa. So even to this day, you know, even though they've had this long relationship, a 25-year or more relationship with Janus Films and Criterion in the United States, you know, I've talked to people in the past who've worked for both of those companies and go, even though we've had this long relationship, they're still difficult when we need materials. Toho did release in 1986 a special video. It was made into it was a documentary on the special effects at Toho during the Eiji Tsuburaya period, called Toho Special Effects Outtakes Collection. That's what it had mostly, or the snippets, the ends, mistakes, and ends and beginnings of shots and other outtakes from the special effects shoots. So there was this great amount of footage in there that no one had ever seen before, including, you know, an impromptu scene on the set of Destroy All Monsters where the Manda marionette is wrapped around a tall skyscraper and Haruo Nakajima playing Godzilla just decides to come up and start pretending he's fighting with Manda.
Yeah, I saw that clip on YouTube. People seem to mention it and wonder if it's a deleted scene, but some rightly say, as you said, that it seemed more like goofing around on set than an outtake more than anything.
Yeah, it was a very impromptu thing that, you know, just didn't really work, and I don't think it would work in the context of the film, you know.
Right.
But it's still beautiful. It's great we can see it. Now, I was told by someone who knew the people working on this documentary, who was a writer for a Japanese science fiction magazine called Uchusen, at the time, he said, you should have seen the footage that didn't get into this documentary. So I imagine there's so much more.
Right.
So in the case of Mothra, that film can still be sitting there, you know, somewhere. We have no
right.
No idea, and I don't think anybody's asked that question to Toho, and it probably, I don't know if it would just get you a blank stare, you know. Next time I go, maybe I should ask.
Therefore, does the movie play out well all through its ending currently, Mothra?
I think currently, as it stands, I think it's probably the best picture that Toho produced up until that time in that genre. It's certainly the biggest and the most expensive. And even the later films, even though the directors and the you know, like Honda and Tsuburaya's crew, his young crew, you know, were really synthesizing their work, they continued to do that up until the mid-60s, and everything became slicker and better. I still think that Mothra is the supreme kaiju eiga. That is the textbook example of, from today's standpoint, what the kaiju eiga is. Because it has all these elements of science fiction, fantasy, a comedy, drama, spectacle, scale. And there's just some amazing, amazing things in that film. And sometimes, you know, as much as I love that film, it's one of my favorites of all time, I still have to shake my fist when I see behind-the-scenes photographs. And I'm going, why did Tsuburaya place the camera there? And he would do multi-camera on everything. Any miniature effect they did, there would be four or five cameras, which a lot of people used to attribute as a patented trademark Kurosawa technique. But that's something that Tsuburaya had been doing for a while. He had that power to do that. And in the case of Mothra, sometimes I'd go like, why didn't he use, I'd see the behind-the-scenes photograph. And you see all this intense detail, and they're shooting as low as possible this publicity photo or behind the scenes photo, and there's all this detail, and then in the film, yeah, he wrecks the same miniature set, and it's a close-up, it's almost from the same, you know, the same distance that the still photographer took this shot, but the film, the movie camera is a little higher,
right,
and you miss all this detail. There's one still where he's attacking a mobile gas station Well, he's running it over, actually. He's not really attacking it. He's just going through everything. And, or she, for those fans out there, are going to go, he got the gender wrong. I know Mothra's a girl. Okay, relax. But as Mothra, the caterpillar, is going through this gas station, you see all this detail. There is a curb, because the gas station's on a corner. You see a curb. You see stanchions. You see chains on the stanchions. You see a Vespa parked in front of the gas station. Oil drums. You don't see any of this in the film. And so sometimes Tsuburaya would just look at the footage he would shoot, and I'm certain that one of the cameras got that. But Tsuburaya went with his gut and would do what he felt was most dramatic, because he also edited all of his special effects footage himself. So, you know, in essence, you know, working with Honda on these films and Mothra, they were essentially co-directors, because Honda would direct all the live action, obviously. Tsuburaya would direct all the special effects, and sometimes Tsuburaya would even direct live action scenes that were going to be incorporated with special effects. If actors were going to be on a blue backing, it wasn't always just extras. You know, I mean, usually like the panic scenes with all the, you know, citizens fleeing, that used to be delegated to sort of second unit work, the second unit director. And on Japanese films, the way the system works is sometimes you'd have three or four assistant directors on one film, and they would be in a, you know, a hierarchy, A, B, C, D. And it would be someone's job to, you know, delegate the authority to shoot just the panic scenes while the director concentrated on the actors. And I think the case was with Mothra, not with Mothra, I'm sorry, with Rodan. There's a famous scene where Rodan flies over the bridge and destroys the bridge, but there's like tourists, and the tourists kind of like calmly get on the buses, and there's a, you know, a woman working for the bus tour company, and she doesn't seem really scared. You know, she's going, everybody on the bus, okay, let's go, you know, kind of, you don't hear her dialogue, but you see her gesture in this medium shot. And she seems like, you know, oh, I'm just getting on the bus. Now, this scene was delegated to a young assistant director at Toho.
Right.
Who kind of got a lot of hell for this. He later became one of the better action directors at Toho. He was under Kihachi Okamoto, who did Kill in 1968 and a lot of other great movies. And he was also assistant director on a couple of Honda pictures before that. But Jun Fukuda was the guy who shot that second unit work. Right. So after that, Tsuburaya said, look, some people are even, they don't, even the extras don't look scared, you know, and then you got the girl and they're like, so after that, Tsuburaya would direct those shots. So he would go out and go, look, everybody's got to look scared. And he was a stickler, you know, for detail. So he would make sure that everyone looked scared.
Kind of what Thunder of Gigantic Serpent looks like. Yeah, just a puppety, snakey thing.
Well, that's when you get when, in that case, Taiwan is originally a Taiwan movie that IFD bought up and cut Westerners into, and therefore renamed the Thunder of Gigantic Serpent. And the original movie is called King of Snake.
That's amazing.
It has actually, it comes off exactly like the Thunder of Gigantic Serpent, and it comes off as I've only seen it with no subtitles, but it kind of doesn't matter. It doesn't make sense at all. And the only fun thing for fans of Hong Kong cinema and Taiwan cinema is that in larger parts in the original, you see Danny Lee start the killer.
He's in every one of these sci-fi fantasy type ones.
He kind of became the Shaw Brothers, puppet actor for their big monster movies in a way. I mean, he got into The Mighty Peking Man. Yep. He was in Oily Maniac. He played Bruce Lee, by the way. And there's another movie.
That was one of the first movies I ever saw that Danny Lee as Bruce Lee showed in New York on television.
Wow.
When I was a kid. That was one of the first non-Bruce Lee or Gordon Lau productions I ever saw.
Wow.
And, oh, wow, what an exploitation movie that is.
But, of course, Inframan. He was an Inframan.
Yeah,
he was
awesome.
Inframan. I mean, so Danny Lee, even late in his career, later in his career, in that King of Snake movie, he's in the most big mystery of that film, both in the original movie and in the Godfrey Ho re-edit, is what the hell is the monster's name? if you hear the trailer, it's like Mosla, maybe.
I've only seen the trailer, and I just love the way the trailer cuts between these very shoddy monster scenes, and then scenes of what looks like a Filipino version of the A-Team mucking about. How are these two things related?
They are not. It's a typical IFD concoction without ninjas this time. They had abandoned the ninja concept by that time, but it has Pierre Kirby in it, and it's about that secret formula. That's usually the style of plotting that IFD went with, you know, secret plans, secret blueprints, and secret formulas, and great fun stuff.
They should just say the secret MacGuffin one time and just...
Would this be the Son of Godzilla? It's not the same as the later film that was just stock footage and a little story about Minya and the kid.
No, that was actually released here in the U.S. as Godzilla's Revenge.
That's right. And that movie I've heard many negative opinions about, so I'm curious to hear your opinion of that.
My opinion on that film is like, again, I saw that in the theater when it first came out.
It must have been a quick screening. I don't think that movie is even 70 minutes long.
It was actually Henry G. Saperstein released that through a subsidiary of his. I think it was called Mayon Films. And he double billed it with a film called Night of the Big Heat, which was a British production with Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing.
Right.
Or, no, just Christopher Lee. I don't think Cushing was in that. I can't recall exactly. But I mean, it was a disappointing programmer. But Godzilla's Revenge popped up, and the joy in that was, for me at the time, was seeing all of that footage from Godzilla versus the Sea Monster, or Godzilla versus Ibira,
right?
And the original Son of Godzilla, and seeing that on the big screen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, which we never got to see on the big screen. So
white screen and all.
Yes, exactly. And so that was the thrill there. And and then of course, seeing all of these different creatures and the monsters and all that. Of course, that we all know that Suburi had passed away before the film went into production.
Right.
So Honda supposedly took over the shooting and staging of the Godzilla footage, and it shows. It shows. I mean, the framing's not. Sadamasa Arakawa basically took over on that project. And it doesn't quite have the flair that Suburio would have brought to it, if he had overseen it. Still, it has a certain amount of charm. But I think what works best on that film is not so much the monster action. I think the actual story about the kid is what made that film unique. It's a children's film, and it's a film about a latchkey kid growing up in Japan. And I think on that level, on a purely innocent level, I had the benefit of actually seeing that film with my nephews. And watching that with, a couple of kids that were like, 10 and 11 years old, they connected with that kid. And so, me as a young man at the time, watching the film and just getting into the monster stuff and the silliness of it, and then catching my kids, my nephews getting involved in that story and relating to it.
Yeah.
It was like, oh my gosh, I had that opportunity of seeing it through another set of eyes. And so I was like, I can appreciate that film on a different level.
It seems like, now I'm not too sure, I'm not going to look it up, but it seems like people nowadays are very much opposed to that choice of making it a children's movie, or it might be that it was just recycled footage. But it does seem like the story that they did film for that film is strong enough to carry a short film.
Well, I think the reason that they didn't, that they used so much stock footage is that basically when Suburia died, the studio decided, well, we don't want to spend that much money on it. Mm-hmm. Their head effects man was gone. And they really, I don't know what the politics was at the time at Toho, but they really didn't give the title of effects director to anybody else until much later, until they did, I believe it was Smog Monster that they actually gave the title of effects director to Nobuku. I think that was his name. I can't recall now.
I'm not too sure myself. So
that's when they gave it over to him. And then, of course, his, his shining moment came in the disaster film, The Submergence of Japan. And, of course, that footage has been used over and over again. In fact, there's actually a scene from Submergence of Japan that shows up in the Rebirth of Godzilla.
Really?
Yes. You know, in 1984, the scene where all of the cars on the freeway are exploding in line along the highway, lifted directly from The Submergence of Japan. So Toho has got to, you know, at that point, it just looked like that they were just going the Roger Corman route. It's like, hey, if we can use a stock footage shot from another film, let's use it.
It doesn't sound like them adjusting to the era we're in now. It just sounds like a bad choice, you know?
Because yeah,
the way you describe it, it's not like, well, it's 2009. That's to be expected.
Right. And, you know, what happened in 2000 is there was a Kamen Rider series. It was a revival. They finally brought the show back called Kamen Rider Kuga. This one, you know, they had good-looking actors, good-looking actresses. Everybody, you know, there was no gender confusion.
Right.
And, you know, it was just done from an honest place where they said, we're just going to make a new superhero show. And it was on at 8 o'clock in the morning time slot on Sundays. Mm. And it's part of what they call now superhero time. But it would play, the one of the Power Rangers show would play at the same, you know, like right after it or right before it. I don't quite remember. But that show attracted because the kids are watching, but so are the moms. The moms started getting involved because the show was written well. And it wasn't written for kids, even though it was on Sunday at 8 a.m. They tried to make a very mature show. And with a long mystery and all these different kind of like X-Files type, you know, story arcs going through it and character arcs that go through it. So you have to pay attention to everything. Unlike the older shows, which would be episodic, you know, you didn't have to follow the whole show to see there wouldn't be these complicated story arcs. They started writing complicated story arcs. The show was great. I was going, wow, this is cool. They're taking this great character, series of characters. They're turning it, you know, they're modernizing it in the best way possible. What happened though was one of the highest rated shows, but mostly the demographic were young mothers. Every year after that, there's a couple of shows that came after that were really good and kept up the quality, but then they started playing to the large female audience that was watching. The boys became prettier. They started wearing more trendy clothes and things like this. And even though the concepts and the action scenes and all that were great, and they started doing the shows as like cliffhangers, you know, would end in a moment where, oh, I have to watch next week because it's a cliffhanger, you know. They're playing it to two things. They're playing it to young boys with the action and the characters and the monsters and all that. And they're playing the character, you know, all the dramatic stuff is played straight to, you know, 25 to 35-year-old women. So it's almost like a soap opera with superheroes in it, written for women. So that's how some of these shows have become. And then the other series, the Sentai series or the Power Rangers type shows, those things, you know, for a few years, they were writing them to the level towards even younger children than they were in the past. And that goes kind of in a secular way where they were making them more into comedies now. So they were almost like serial comic adventures.
Yeah.
And now it's coming around. The last couple of shows have been less ridiculous and more serious where you don't feel like you're sitting there watching it and you become embarrassed realizing you're watching a bunch of people running around in spandex costumes. So, which isn't a bad thing when there's old shows like in the 80s, they pushed the envelope back in the 80s and they were doing things that alarmed the Japanese PTA. Mm-hmm. And they tried to stop them from having so much violence. I mean, the Japan Action Club, which was founded by Sonny Chiba, they were doing the action scenes for all these shows, and they were doing things like kicking the bad guys in the groin.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember watching one of the first shows I saw that had that. Like, it was in 1979. We got a videotape from Japan. It was a series called Battle Fever J, and it starred one of Sonny Chiba's proteges, Kenji Oba, who was later went on to be in Kage no Gundan, or the Shadow Warriors, and was also in Kill Bill Volume 1.
Right.
He was the shaved head assistant to in Chiba's sushi shop.
Right.
And anyway, he played this character that jumps up into a tree after a bad guy henchman. And they jump up in the tree, and the bad guy has his legs stretched out, one on one branch, one on the other branch, and the superhero jumps up in the tree, this is Kenji Oba's character, and then kicks him right between the legs. The guy doubles over, falls out of the tree like 20 feet, and we just went, yes! This is what makes these shows great. And there was another element that started changing once the PTA started getting them to do less violence. The Bandai company, big juggernaut toy company, they started really wielding a lot more power on these shows, and they wanted more scenes with the robots and the vehicles and the things like this. So the martial arts started getting downplayed, and all the action scenes with the mecha, the vehicles and the robots, became more prominent. And then they started doing ridiculous things in the late 80s, early 90s, where you would have the superhero team would eventually end up, they'd start with one robot and end up with 15 when the show was over, you know, when the series concluded. So, you know, you look back and you go, what has happened? You know, it's like, you know, these shows are not the shows that I grew up with. So, you know, you also have that little bit of prejudice.
What do you think of Cloverfield?
I was struck when I saw Cloverfield about how much it reminded me of the spirit of Godzilla, where it was, you know, Godzilla took real events with, you know, it was 8 years, probably eight, not even, after the atomic bombings, and probably less than a year after the Lucky 7 incident. And they made this incredibly heartfelt, I mean, we're still talking about it today, like it's a, you know, it's a masterpiece. And then I came out of Cloverfield, which was made within 6 years of the September 11th attacks, tried to do the same thing with the imagery that Godzilla did, and was just empty. I just walked out like saying, wow, the American attempt at taking a national tragedy and making some kind of, you know, pop culture meaning out of it is a failure compared to that Japanese one on in every level.
That's,
I mean,
it
just gave me a headache. Personally, the shaky cam just gave me a headache, and I just kept trying to imagine what the person who was holding the camera was doing to shake it that much throughout the movie.
I know they attempted that, and I never got any emotional response from Cloverfield. Oddly enough, I have a weak thing for, horror and fear documented through a camera like that, albeit not as shaky. I'm weak for that. Therefore, I kind of like Cloverfield as that experience, but not as any, you know, meaningful parallel to 9/11 or as any contender.
It did really. I mean, I am from New York, and so it really did. While watching it, you were, you know, it was just familiar in a not pleasant way.
Yeah.
But it just didn't. I mean, there was no. It didn't feel like anything but for, you know, teenagers at the mall to spend a couple bucks for. It didn't have any resonance whatsoever. Yet, it did make me a little uncomfortable because of the imagery.
Yeah. I mean, you never know when it's time to bring out that, or if it's time to bring out that.
Bringing it out. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Ishiro Honda managed to make it because of the qualities we've discussed that he possessed, and the movie ultimately, you know.
It's simple and genuine, I think, exactly. I mean, it's hard. It's on his sleeve. When I saw Godzilla in the theater just 2 years ago, when they had the re-release, everyone was embracing it really, really wholeheartedly. But there was one part, and it does have moments where you are supposed to laugh.
Yeah.
But one of those parts when Godzilla approaches Tokyo Tower and there's a reporter there who is broadcasting up to the very end, and he is killed with the tower. There was a guy in the theater who was laughing at that. And I was like, it just struck me as like, you know, it's too bad that that person is trying to think about this in an ironic way. you know, there are plenty of moments where you're supposed to do that in the movie that are a little amusing. I mean, it's an entertainment pop culture movie from its, you know, as it's meant to be an entertainment. But that wasn't one of them. And I just, you know, some audiences are tough to grab sometimes, I think. Or people just have changed over the last 55 years. And something that where you see that and you're just struck by how dedicated this one guy is. He's broadcasting to the end and he's trying to explain the suffering that's going on. And then, you know, 55 years later, some goof is laughing at that. Just rubbed me the wrong way.
It's you never know how an audience is going to react, but it's a fun thing for me to, when people watch one of the stills from Godzilla with him with the train, eating the train basically, that looks goofy and funny as a still, but probably is the most disturbing scene for me in the film, because the way it's done, the special effects, and it's people just being fucking splattered to death. Basically,
they do, and that's one thing that is something that they do again and again in these movies. They know that it's because it's grounded. Everybody identifies with commuting somewhere on a train, and then suddenly, kaboom! You know, it's the world turned upside down. It's a great thing that they do wisely do over and over again. King Kong does it in King Kong versus Godzilla, and there's a great scene in the Gamera movie from the 90s where the train is attacked. Just great. And it's one of those things where people identify with it.
Yeah.
You know, people see it and they see something that's common to them.
Did you ever see the IFD concoction Thunder of Gigantic Serpents?
I have not seen the film, although I have seen the trailer, and it's just like, I'm just sitting there, it's like, I'm terrified. How did they manage to match all that footage together?
It's not really hard, because I've seen the original film, albeit unsubtitled. It's a Taiwan film.
And it was called King Snake, wasn't it?
King of Snake, indeed. Stars, okay. Danny Lee is in that, and of course, Danny Lee was part of many weird monster movies from Shaw Brothers.
Yeah, Goliathon, or Mighty Peking Man.
Inframan, and what have you. But it's actually, the story in the original is kind of sliding along the same lines as the IFD version. They just added the secret formula plot. So the movies are not that drastically different. It's not like when they did basically took a Taiwan melodrama and added ninja scenes to it. It's not that the contrasts aren't as big, so it kind of works. And I always find it amusing that you never find out what what the name of the monster is, because this little kid keeps calling Mosla, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not too sure. And even listening to it in Mandarin, I still can't figure it out.
Yeah, it's just like, I see the kid, you know, it's like in the trailer, and she's yelling out the snake's name, and it's just like, okay, there's something, it's like, this is like a deity or something. And it's just like, okay.
Did you see this sequence from... I think it's the sequel to Always Sun on the Third Street. I don't have the title, but it begins with a 5-minute dream sequence, which is basically a Godzilla movie, set in the 50s, Godzilla attack.
Right.
Kind of thing. Did you see that? What did you think of the feeling they captured?
Yeah, I think they really captured it really well. You know, and Yamazaki, the director, who did the first Always as well,
right,
which was, you know, which swept the Japanese Academy Awards. It was biggest box office hit in years for Toho. And Yamazaki also he loves special effects. He started out as a special effects artist. In all of his films, and Always, the first film, I don't know if you saw the original Always.
No, I did not.
It's great. I recommend it. You know, it's just him recreating the old Tokyo of late 50s through almost entirely green screen and CGI is amazing. Just his attention to detail is amazing. He started out doing a film about 8 years ago called Juvenile, which was about a robot from outer space that lands on Earth and befriends some children, and the evil bad aliens are coming. Actually a nice, fun film. It was released in Hong Kong and Taiwan, and it was issued on a DVD with English subtitles in Hong Kong. It kept the same title, Juvenile. And then he did another film with you might have heard, I'm sure, is The Returner.
Yeah, I didn't see it because it didn't look to me any good, to be honest.
Yeah, it's actually fun. It's very derivative, but it's a fun picture. Hmm. It's a fun picture, and it kind of, by watching it, you could see that the Japanese can, even though maybe the film would not, maybe as a whole, stand out as a timeless classic of any kind. But you could see that the Japanese just technically are able to produce films that are slick as American films on less of a budget. And, you know, that also factors into the fact that there's no unions really in Japan, which is why, you know, the films are more in it, more, you know, cheaper to produce.
Right.
But anyway, so Yamazaki has done all this stuff, and he did that Always too with the Godzilla sequence, which I thought was fantastic. His next film, now he's got so much power in Japan, and they're putting a lot of money into this. Right now he's filming a new film. It's a science fiction film, and it's based on one of the most famous series of movies and TV out of Japan ever, which is Space Battleship Yamato. And he's doing that entirely green screen. And what he's doing with that picture, it's a Toho picture. It comes out next December. They're shooting the live action right now, and half of the actors in the cast are Japanese Academy Award winners. And there's one guy from SMAP, one of the pop bands, mm-hmm. but he's already, you know, a veteran actor now.
Right.
He's like 36 now. And anyway, they're doing this now. They're shooting it. And then in December, I think they're shooting for about a month. Month and a half, the live action. Then he's going to spend the next 9 months doing the special effects.
Right.
That's unprecedented for a Japanese film.
And
when Tsuburaya was doing his films back in the 60s, analog style, you know, the most you had was probably about 6 weeks to shoot all those special effects. You know, and, you know, now he's got 9 months to do this thing. You know, admittedly, they're saying the film is 80% going to be 80% CGI. But the way that this guy does stuff, as you saw with the opening of Always 2, and which was done on a lesser budget, this is a big budget film that they're doing with Space Battleship Yamato, much bigger than Always, I should say, because they expected that to be a huge hit, and it really didn't do as well as the first film. This film is probably going to be amazing. I'm really looking, as you're asking me, can I keep up with everything? I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, and you're going to keep up with that one. You're not going to lose sight of that one.
I've been a big fan of Yamazaki's. I've been a champion of his for a while.
Right.
I was a champion of Ryuhei Kitamura's, you know, who did Versus and did Izumi. And then I was, when I heard that he was going to be doing the Godzilla film, Final Wars, I was excited. And then I saw the film, I was disappointed. Kitamura let me down, so I'm hoping Yamazaki doesn't let me down, because Godzilla was a big thing. And growing up, for me, Space Battleship Yamato was very big with me. And I'm a huge, huge, huge fan of that. And I'm hoping he doesn't let me down on that one next year. And just so people don't get confused, there's a new animated film of Space Battleship Yamato. The first one since 1980, has it been that long? 83. And it's opening in Japanese theaters this December from Toho. And then next year is the live-action Space Battleship Yamato film. So... you know, I'm really looking forward to that. And there's the big new Ultraman movie coming out in December, too, which is, interestingly enough, they're marketing it. They're hoping to market these overseas. They're doing a trilogy called Ultra Galaxy, or The Legend of the Ultra Galaxy, or something like that.
Just put Legend in front of anything.
Yeah, you know, someone's going to write a complaint letter to me. They're planning that as a trilogy, and that's being done with Warner Brothers Japan and the company that Eiji Tsuburaya founded, Tsuburaya Productions.
Right.
And they're hoping to do a trilogy, and it's being directed by, let's see, what's his name? This is bad, because now I'm remembering the guy's name. Koichi Sakamoto. I almost said the singer of YMO. You know, the guy from Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. I almost got Ryuichi Sakamoto was wanting to come out, and I knew that I was going, it's not, it's Koichi Sakamoto.
Right.
Koichi Sakamoto was a Japanese stuntman who loved Ultraman and all that stuff when he was a kid and wanted to be one of the suit actors, and did a little bit of that. And then when they started shooting the Power Rangers show in the United States, and the American stunt performers couldn't really match the Japanese footage, because it just wasn't looking the same because, you know, this was a Japanese style that was created. They started, you know, having the Japanese stuntmen come over to shoot the scenes in the United States, in Southern California. And Koichi worked up the ranks from stuntman to the lead choreographer to writer, director, and producer. And he's still the producer of the Power Rangers franchise.
Now the name finally clicked for me because I think he's the action director of Drive, the Mark Dacascos film, if you ever heard of that. I think his stunt team worked on Drive.
Yeah, I believe he did work on Drive, yes.
And that's a fantastic movie for many Hong Kong fans because it's like the sole Western-produced movie that successfully incorporated Hong Kong-style action without it feeling forced.
Right, exactly.
Drive's a fantastic film, and that action is just great.
And it gave Mark Dacascos a really good part, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Interestingly enough, going off on a tangent, Steve Wang, who directed that film, I've known him since the early 80s. He grew up in San Jose. He was born in Taiwan, but he came to the United States when he was young with his family and settled in San Jose, California, which is known around the world as Silicon Valley now. And I, at a convention, met a friend. I met someone who became my friend, this guy, Johnny Espirito, who also goes by Johnny Psycho, as in the Japanese Psycho, S-A-I-K-O, as in the best. And Johnny and I hit it off, met his brother, not his brother, but a really good friend of his, who happened to be Steve Wang's older brother. Steve was younger than us and was by a few years and was really crazy about, you know, Ultraman monsters. And there was a convention coming up, and everybody was encouraging him to, he wanted to make a monster suit. So we all encouraged him to make, and he made a monster suit from one of the monsters from Ultra 7, Icarus Saging, which is this alien that kind of is part bat, part humanoid, big bat ears, kind of gray. And so he made this suit, and I think it was Don Post Jr. from the famous Don Post Mask Company was one of the judges. Or was the judge at the contest, and Steve took first place. And then he started to go on to, you know, doing more makeup work. And as he got older, he moved into that and then moved into directing. He, you know, moved to Hollywood in 1985. And that's when a lot of us all went our separate ways after that point.
Right.
And Steve moved to Hollywood with a couple of friends and made quite a career for himself and then made Drive, which is, not to sound too, you know, smug, or in a better word, not to sound too too much like a snob, it kicks ass.
I hope you've seen his original version as well, because it was cut and shortened and the score altered for American video release. So if you haven't seen the long version of the...
Oh, yeah, I saw the long version, yeah.
Which is a pretty good movie. I mean, it doesn't have bad dramatic choices when it intends to. I mean... For that kind of movie, it plays well.
Yeah, I wasn't, you know, I'm usually very critical about martial arts films in terms of, like, the dramatic parts.
Yes.
And, you know, it's like, well, forget all this fooling around and stupid stuff. Just get back to fighting.
Yeah.
You know, you get to that point where, we're going to have to fast forward. But, you know, all the stuff that was in that film was interesting, and the funny parts were actually genuinely funny.
Yeah. It could have been really corny with, trailer lines like we have the original Five Fingers of Death here. Pow! You know, could really be corny in a Chris Tucker kind of way, but Kadeem Hardison doesn't annoy at all in a Chris Tucker way, on the contrary.
Right, and I thought it was really well done. It's a fun movie.
Where's the Kaiju t-shirt? Have you done it? Have you done one?
I do have a Kaiju shirt. I have a... Zero Saur versus Wolf Human. See, I kind of.
Is that made up?
I just make stuff. I kind of plot out a movie, and then make the poster for the movie that I've plotted out. And that most of my shirts, the movie ones, are for, you know, a fictitious film that I've said, what if.
Yeah.
Like my Chambara shirt is kind of a what if Akira Kurosawa remade The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly with Toshirô Mifune, Tetsuya Nakadai, and Shintaro Katsu as the characters. Or what if the Toshirô Mifune was in a Honda monster movie and it had a supernatural thing? So the Zero Sword versus, instead of twin fairies, you have a gypsy. You know, instead of the Gargantua, you have kind of a wolf man thing. Whereas most stuff that you see, like the designs of stuff, they try and modernize old stuff. Like if you see any Godzilla t-shirts, they always have this kind of heavy metal vibe. Yeah. Or there really aren't any good Kung Fu movie shirts. Like the Bruce Lee, I don't know if you saw, I posted online about how I just came back from that trade show where they had Bruce Lee in front of a Japanese Rising Sun flag on the t-shirts. And I was like, why?
Well, see,
it's,
you
just
know,
terrible.
No one has made like a Peking Opera Blues shirt or a Quan Ta Hing shirt. I mean, that's the stuff that appeals to me.
I'm trying. Even the Peking Opera Blues one, even though it's called Peking Opera Blues, it's sort of my own version of Peking Opera Blues. Mm. And if you look close, like I'll sneak in, if you look close at my Wonton Western, which is the spaghetti Western via Hong Kong movie one, mm-hmm. which translates literally to Chinese noodle cowboy story.
Yeah, they did some remarkable stuff. Nikatsu, when they did Gappa, they, you know, again, they bought an old optical printer. I think they got one from, Film Effects in Hollywood. I think it was, I can't even think of the gentleman's name now, Rabin or something like that. Mm. I think, you know, but, they got one of his old optical printers, and so they had to readjust that to handle color film. But, you know, so, you know, they did a very, very nice job on Gappa. But again, Gappa was sort of like their remake of Gorgo.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, but it's like, still, they came up with a wonderful mythology and, you know, a wonderful aspect to that thing. And here's the funny thing. It's like, if you ever see the American version on that, the dubbing on that, because, you know, Nikatsu's version is like, it's a satire and it's got some very humorous moments. When they did the dubbing, some of the lines come off absolutely hilarious. And there's one that is incredibly racial. And it's just like, you know, there's actually a newscast where they talk about, you know, the monsters are in the city and they're destroying the city and all this. But fortunately, this is only in the poorer sections of town.
Oh, my.
You know, it's like, but it's like, in the American version, it basically plays almost like it's like, but this is only playing in the Negro sections of town. It's like, oh my God, you know, and it's just, oh Christ, you know, and, you know, when this film came out in 1966, it's like, you know, again, we're just going through that uprest, and it's like, there's go, they're thumbing their finger at us.
My.
You know, so it's like,
not a good slip of the tongue, that.
Well, no, but, you know, again, it's a satire, so it's like, I mean, you know, that was something that's like, well, it's only happening in this part of town, so you don't have to worry about it. And so it's like, it's playing that up. And it's like, again, it's like, okay, well, if there was that kind of devastation, would it, you know, it cover the news and everything else? Is, but it's not happening in Beverly Hills.
They produced another Gamera picture a couple of years ago called Gamera the Brave. I don't know if you've seen that.
I've only heard the title of it.
Title? Okay. Yeah, it's kind of a mix of what Kaneko was doing and the 60s Gamera, but with a little more of like the kind of current Japanese kid pitcher mentality. You know, it's got a little Steven Spielbergishness to it. Mm. The child actors are great. There's a couple sequences in there that were done just for laughs for kids that weren't silly slapstick necessarily. They're cute. They're cute comedy scenes that I don't think were really necessary. It's juxtaposed with grim violence. Bad monster in this thing, which is probably, you know, the best monster suit I've ever seen out of Japan. Probably, you know, for a Western sensibility, it's probably the most realistic. It's kind of like a frilled lizard, like a giant frilled lizard, and it walks forward, and it's just really nice. It's really nice. But it eats people. So it eats children, too. And it eats children in this film. So that might, just on that recommendation, you might want to look at it.
Yeah.
But, you know, and the story's sweet and it's got some good stuff in it. But You know, and it was directed by one of the guys who did the recent Kamen Rider shows, and he was a graduate of the Power Rangers shows. And he was his first turn at doing a kaiju eiga. And it did terribly at the Japanese box office, but it's not a bad movie. It just doesn't have a perfect center, but it's not a bad movie. They were going to launch a couple of other films off of that, including rebooting Daimajin. And they were going to give that to Takashi Miike. What happened with that was Gamera the Brave failed at the Japanese box office, so they called off the Daimajin film. However, earlier this year, they announced that they were going to be making a Daimajin TV series, and that is in production right now.
Yeah, Harudata. Which could be fun if they adhere to, the original feeling of the movies and not make a quick, goofy product out of it.
It's supposedly going to be like one of those late-night Japanese series, so it's aimed at a young adult audience.
Right.
So it's one of those shows that's going to air like at 11 o'clock midnight, and it's also, while it's set in a modern setting, there are flashbacks to the feudal period that are going to be happening in the show. I don't know how it's done and how they're doing it. I've just seen the production photos. It was originally supposed to start airing this month in Japan, and then they decided to push it back to spring of next year. So we'll see what happens with that. I'm kind of looking forward to that. There's these other little pictures that are coming out. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there. There's so much we could talk for hours, but there's too much stuff.
Right. Here's a little side note. There was one project that Harry Saperstein, when he was doing the distribution in the 70s, and he tried to talk Toho into it, and he was trying to get funding to co-produce it. Mm-hmm. And it was right after The Exorcist had hit, and he tried to sell them on the idea of doing Godzilla versus the Devil.
Wow. The ultimate battle.
Yeah, it's just like, okay, all right. You know, this is like Henry, God bless his heart. He loved Godzilla, and he promoted it and did what he could with it. But it's like, I'm sorry, he was just probably one of the worst writers out there. You know, it's just like, I mean, you just look at his original idea for Frankenstein Conquers the World, and it's just like, I mean, it worked great for War of the Gargantuas, but that original Frankenstein Conquers the World, Frankenstein's still beating heart is going to, like a newt, grow a new body and a new brain. It's like, thanks, Henry.
I found it entertaining to have a contact in Germany who knows a little bit about monster movies in Germany. And for some reason, they attached Frankenstein to a whole lot of titles, even though they didn't apply. The Destroy All Monsters is Frankenstein und die Monster aus dem All.
Yes, so, Frankenstein's Monster from Outer Space. It's like there's some great titles from Germany. It's like, and of course it's always Frankenstein's and Frankenstein or Kong.
Yeah, exactly.
My favorite is always like Italy would always throw Kong in the title. Uh-huh. You know, it's like I always thought that was hilarious. Like what was it? Godzilla versus the Thing is like King Kong's Nightmare was the title in Italy. It's like, I thought that was just absolutely hilarious.
They did a similar thing with a lot of Hong Kong movies or martial arts movies. Basically, anything with Jimmy Wang Yu had Wang Yu before the German title. So Wang Yu, so on. And Bruce Lee, obviously, where, of course, Bruce Lee did not appear. Maybe not at all. Maybe not a reference to Bruce Lee, but Bruce Lee and then a German title on that.
They didn't do so much the Bruce Lee thing because they couldn't get away with it, but they'd always have Dragon in the title.
Oh, yeah.
And so we had Dragon versus Needles of Death. We had Dragon Dies Hard. You know, this is like just all of these hilarious titles.
It's
like
all about hard titles, my friend. Dragon, Ninja, Master. Legend is, of course, the trademark Miramax. Yep. if you have that in your title, then you can do anything.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like, you know, what George Romero says, like, you know, he could get funding for any movie just so long he has Of the Dead somewhere in the title.
Right. Kind of sad, kind of good, depending on the movie you're allowed, if you're allowed to make an actual movie based on that pitch. But